almost 5 years ago, I had the idea that there needed to be a bigger focus on Kansas City musicians out in the world. I went to numerous shows with the OG musicians in this town. The Danny Embrys and the Stanton Kesslers and the Doug R. Waters of the world were blowing me away musically. And I was also impressed by the younger talent, the Paula Saunders of the world, the Matt Hoppers of the world, and the Jackie Myers of the world. So I drew upon my broadcast journalism background and stopped by Matt Hopper's house way back in October 2019. We had a really nice chat and the quote-unquote casual conversations with musicians about their craft podcast began. I've done 160 episodes, most of this on my own, the last 7 or 8 with my good buddy Billy Decker. It's been a real joy, but it's time to say goodbye. There are way too many people for me to thank, but I would first like to thank all of my KC friends who came on really early. You know who you are. Thanks for agreeing to be a part of this podcast you knew nothing about. You launched me. Thank you. My favorite part of being a musician are the connections that I have made. Jacqueline Tabor came on my radar because she asked a question of the Kansas City Musicians Forum, and I answered her. This led to the beginning of a friendship that really blossomed when I interviewed her for this podcast. Jacqueline is fabulous. She's out of Seattle. Take a moment and listen to her. Music really does bring people together. I also want to thank the people who I knew I'd never really talked to, but have now become my friends, Andy Alladort and Chris McLaren, and both stand-up guys with wicked senses of humor who also tell great stories and are a fabulous musician. Please stay in touch, fellas. I really appreciate you. To the musicians who I knew a little bit but got to know a whole lot more, I also say thank you, Ian Moore, Wayne Sutton, folks like that, Ian in particular. Ian's music is the soundtrack of my wife's and my entire relationship. I could not ever thank you enough, Ian. I knew you'd be great, but you were great, so thank you. To all the people who played on the theme song, you just heard on the intro, for free, which is a really generous thing for them to do. They're all great professional musicians, and they usually get paid to work, so thank you. First, Gogo Ray on the drums, not only a phenomenal drummer, he's an even better human being. Gogo came to my house and recorded his drums on my crappy electronic kit. It made it sound amazing because that's what he does. But besides Gogo, Blake Eberhard, who started out as a guest on this podcast, but who became not only a friend, but a dude I got the privilege to play out with live several times. Blake provided the bass part. Tyson Leslie, whose background story, if you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back to. It's really interesting. One of the best background stories out there. But he provided both the piano part and the Hammond B3 part. Thank you, Tyson. Bobby freaking Harris played the sax solo on this track. Bobby Harris, the Grammy Award winner, one of the founding members of the Daz Band fame. Thanks, Bobby. And then finally, my sister from another mister, Laura Ellis, who did the vocals. Laura, you always blow me away. Laura and I have done projects now together for almost a decade, and it's one of the most satisfying musical relationships I've ever had. A beautiful voice and a beautiful person. To the PR people, who started out as people just booking guests on this podcast but became friends, Wendy Brentford-Jones, especially, and Amanda Kagan, thank you. Your kindness is very, very appreciated. To the guitar gods, who I followed my whole adult life but never had the chance to say hello, much less have a conversation until this podcast, Neil Giraldo, Andy Timmons, Ty Tabers, and of course, Eric Johnson. Holy shit, I got to talk to Eric Johnson and ask questions. You were all friendly, gracious, and kind. Thank you very much. To the new guitar heroes for me, who were great to chat with, Gretchen Min and Nili Brosh, both fabulous. Please check them out. All the strong women artists that I admired and who took the time to say hello, Florence, Dore, Nikki Bloom, Tanya Donnelly especially, you all kick ass. Thank you. To the many new musicians, there's too many of them to mention, but I especially enjoyed my chats with Anastasia Elliott, the Bird Street's John Brodeur, and Royal Sugar. Again, listen to their music. It's really good. I could go on and on and on. 95% of this journey has been totally rewarding and lovely. And I'm not going to worry about the 5% that suck because there's no use in putting any energy into negative situations or people. They just aren't worth it. Lastly, to all those who have listened, a heartfelt thank you. In this digital age, there are literally millions of choices for your time, and you chose to listen to me, of all people, the schmo with the show. It's very humbling. Having people come up to me and tell me how much they loved an episode has made my day. Hell, it made my week. So if you still want to listen to me, you can follow my historic murder podcast, Going to Killing City, that I co-host with my evil twin, Alex Greenwood. That will continue, but trading for ends today. Now, I'm going to say what I always say, because I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Go out and support live music. Thanks for listening, people. Here is my conversation, my last conversation with Tim Easton.
Tim, thanks so much for coming on Trading Fours. It's a treat to get to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I am always so enamored of good songwriting.
Cheers.
And your whole career, it's kind of almost like a class on how to write good songs. And I know that John Prine was an influence. So let's talk a little bit before we talk about the album specifically. Can we talk a little bit about your influences about your songwriting?
Yeah, man. Well, early on, we'd have to say John and Paul, big part of it there, a Beatles thing. And someone, you know, pointed out recently that I cross back and forth between writing personal songs that are true to my life, you know, singing in the first person, and this is my life, this is what's going on. And that's how this new album starts with Find Your Way. And then the next song is also personal. But then after that, soon after that, I go into Randy Newman territory, who's kind of an influence on me too. And that's where I'm making up characters and kind of writing little films. And like the song Little Brother, for example. I don't have a little brother. I am the little brother, actually. Four older brothers that had a lot of records, you know, and two older sisters that had a lot of records. So I learned early on from some of the greats and then some of the pop heroes as well. But my brothers made sure that I listened to like Doc Watson and John Prine and stuff that was more about the heroes of my heroes. Like, who did the Beatles listen to? The Everly Brothers. Well, what were they all about? And then what were the Leuven Brothers about? Like, it was a steady course in going back in time. And now I'm like, I honestly am learning the standards now.
Like the Great America Songbook kind of stuff?
Yeah, I got that. And I've got a couple of those. And I've just like when I was 14 years old and writing my first songs, I had the Beatles songbook and I was like, oh, a B minor goes with a D chord. You know, I didn't understand music and music theory. Or 1-4-5. I just saw these chords work together in this Beatles song. So I would just flip them around and hang on one chord longer and just write my own songs using the chords that were in their book, right? Like I distinctly remember using the chords to drive my car to write one of my first songs. And it sounds nothing like that song. And so now with the Great American Songbook, I'm like, oh, that's a cool jazz progression.
Yeah.
Just kind of rearrange it and start writing a new song. And I crimp from the best still when I'm trying to not necessarily meet a quota, but I do have a Patreon page. And every now and then it gets down to crunch time. It's like, oh, I could just write another blues and give that to my Patreon page, or I could actually work on something and craft something, you know, because, you know, every day it's not like it's dropping out of the sky on me, like these songs, you know, but some days they are. And this record is about 80% songs that really just dropped out of the sky and I wrote them down. I'm really lucky. One or two of them were crafted. One of them was crafted in a songwriting workshop, actually. A song called Bangin' Drum Inside My Mind was a blues that I wrote with a group of people.
So it's interesting. The this was during the lockdown, right? This is when you wrote most of this?
I did, right? Sitting right on this couch with that Tim Gibson. In my sister's painting behind me, this is a painting of a fire horse she did. Okay. My sister's a great visual artist, you know, so a huge influence on me. And she, very consummate. She's probably painting right now down in Georgia. So I do write a lot. I try to write every day. I try to show up every day. And I learned that from my heroes of songwriting, you know. Bob Dylan would be certainly another influence in regards to just write. Don't try to worry about what's going on around you. Just keep on going. And of course, you know, when you pick guys like that, you know, that's some high level stuff, right? John Prine, Joni Mitchell, very personal, always writing about herself. John Prine, not John Prine describing situations that he observed, you know, it's not necessarily his life that he's singing about. So he found a balance there that is very inspirational, very influential for not just songwriters, just human beings in general, I think.
Yeah, it's such, I find the whole creative process fascinating. In fact, I don't usually do audiobooks a ton. I usually like to actually physically read, but Malcolm Gladwell did a whole book about Paul Simon. I don't know if you know about this at all. And he interviewed Paul like 1,000 times. And to your point, you know, Paul actually started writing songs for other people. I know he knew Carole King back when she was Carole Kane. And but there's a lot of grinding to it, isn't there? I mean, that's a lot of it. You got to grind.
Yeah, well, that's the crafting thing. It's like inspirato versus like, okay, we got to craft this out. Sometimes you just, you know, Neil Young said something about it, like that little melody that's going through your head when you're brushing your teeth in the morning or whatever. That's it. And whatever that is, try to pin it down and try to get a verse and a chorus out of it. And that is true. There's a song on my new album called By the End of the Night, which is like the first real romantic love song I wrote in a standard format. Like, this is a standard. It could have been from the 40s. It could be from the future. And I remember thinking, okay, I want to write like a song that the Everly Brothers could sing, and or Nat King Cole or something, you know, like just ridiculous ideas, right? But it was mid-pandemic, and I found a cassette. You know, now we use our phones, right? And we have like thousands of voice memos of little chunks of things. But I had a cassette that just had the chorus, by the end of the night. Actually, that's all it had. It's just that line. And I was like, what is that? And I found it, I found it, maybe 20-year-old thing that a scrap of song. And I crafted it into a song on the spot. I was just like, oh, this is fun. I'll just do it. And I leaned into it. And yeah, I got to thank that pandemic time for that, for really getting into the craft a little bit more. And for also just also permitting me more time to hang out with my family and my daughter. And yeah, it's John Hiatt, another influence to me. Said, you should finish the song that you started. Don't just, you know, sing a little scrap of it into your voicemail, because you'll never finish it. How many thousands of those do you have? And I'm sure that if you sat down, you know, Jason Isbell, Casey Chambers, you know, just a bunch of songwriters today here in Nashville, if you sat them down and just said, pull up voicemail 72. Like, there would be dozens, if not hundreds, of scraps on these on our phones, and they are full of them, and they're taking up all that space. And I personally would love to have that panel, like at Americana Fest.
Yeah, wouldn't you?
Five songwriters had to plug their phones in and I randomly pick a number. Although I have to say, today it gives the address. You know, it gives the address to where you are. So I live on Woods Lake Drive, you know, so it says my address, Woods Lake 1, Woods Lake 2, you know, it just says it over and over again. And I try to name them, but sometimes you don't have time for that. I'm just telling any songwriters that's listening to this, you should make time. The world can wait for you. Just slow down, get the verse and chorus done, so that if you have to abandon it after that, at least you can come back and maybe just write another verse or a bridge or something. But yeah, there's a lot of half written songs out there.
Totally. So one of the things I want to talk to you, because I had her on, that she was actually at Folk Alliance last year, I think. I interviewed Jamie Harris.
Oh yeah.
And I know you and Jamie did a tune together. So talk to me a little bit about, I'm sure yeah, you man. Knew each other a long time, but how did this all come?
No, we met at the House of Songs in Arkansas. It's in Bentonville, Arkansas. It's a really cool organization called the House of Songs, and you can apply to be part of it. And I got pulled in there by Troy Campbell and Matt the Electrician. And basically, they got me in there, and, also Graham Weber was there. He was running it. He was good friends with Jamie Harris. And I got pulled in. So you sit in a house for 5 days with like 8 songwriters. And I was paired up with like Willie. Why am I spacing out right now?
Because it's morning.
Yeah. So
you have a tornado warning going on.
Yeah, there is a tornado effect. So there was just Willie Carlisle, for God's sakes.
Okay.
Willie Carlisle and I, you know, he was unknown. We met in there. Jamie Harris, I didn't know Jamie Harris. I immediately noticed she had a Towns Van Zandt tattoo on her arm. So that was kind of a thing where I'm like, okay, that's an influence on me for sure. I got to open up for Towns years ago. It's a whole other podcast right there.
Right.
So Jamie and I were matched up to write, you know. And you know what? If you're going to write, matched up with five songwriters in a couple of days, you're not all going to write a song, you know? As it turns out, my friend Meredith and I, we'd never met. We met on the front porch and we finished a song called Anchor, which ended up on my last album. And then Jamie and I met and I wrote down this line. I hear you singing in the kitchen and you know it's sinking my heart.
It's a great line, man.
Yeah, I wrote, I hear you singing in the kitchen and you know it's sinking my heart. I was like, kitchen, sinking. I was like, inner rhyme thing, whatever. I wrote it down. And then we just blabbed for like 45 minutes or an hour about relationships and this and that. And we never really wrote anything past that. But I took that line in the pandemic. This is, you know, pre-pandemic is when I met her at the House of Songs. And I just took that line and I just finished it. And I wrote a song about, I made up a song about a wild, you know, codependent, ne'er-do-well group, you know, couple that, you know, listens to the Stanley Brothers and drives through Tennessee and Arkansas and whatever, and, you know, gets in trouble. And it just wrote itself. I just wrote it really fast and I made it a country blues and turned it into my Patreon page as I do. And then when I gave that song and like 50 other songs to my producer, Leroy Stagger up in Canada, the guy that wrote the grant so that it enabled me to come to Canada and make an album because my mom's Canadian. That was just one of 50 songs I gave him and he pulled it out. It's like, we're going to work on this. And, you know, but it was already done. So Jamie I listed her as a co-writer on there, but really she was kind of just there when I wrote that first line. We talked a bunch and then later it became the song that it became. And I think the right thing to do in Nashville, they say, if you say a word, you get a third or whatever. That's some ridiculous co-write statement. I'm not a big co-writing guy. I mean, I say that now and someone could show up and we could write a banger, but I don't do it very often. I'm not seeking it out the way some people are, although I will try and I will go for it because you never know. There's a songwriter in Texas named Anna De La Mar, and I said one thing on a text thing with her after Folk Alliance. We met at Folk Alliance and I said one thing about, we're all just bastard children. I asked her where her family was from. She said, Italy, you know, Italy, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm Germany, Wales. You know, we're all just European bastard children. And then she wrote a line from that. The next thing you know, we wrote this really historic song about immigrants, you know, in America. So you never know when it's gonna happen. And I wrote a song with Oliver Wood over text as well. That's one of my favorite things I've ever done is work with that guy and then get together and finish a song. And it's called Dolores. It came out last year. It was a benefit for homeless people in Nashville.
Okay. Well, so much to unpack, but Matt the Electrician, my cousin Laura is his manager. So
oh yeah,
it's that small of a world.
Right.
Down in Austin. You know, it's interesting. I'm reading Desmond Child's autobiography. And it's kind of interesting too, because he kind of had this thing that he was the song fixer, right? He'd come in and write songs. But even in his book, he really wanted to do his own music. It's more of a satisfaction, but you got to make a living too, right? I mean, that's part of the whole component. So I want to talk a little bit about your background because, you know, I read people, everybody sends me stuff. I always try to read it and be ready for it. And then when I see grew up in, I think it was Akron, Ohio, right? And then Japan. And I was like, military kid, like, Tim, tell me how you ended up over there. How did that all happen?
My dad worked for Goodyear. And that's based in Akron. It's Rubber City. Quite a rock and roll town, actually. Devo is from there. And Chrissy Hynde and the Black Keys. Turns out Chrissy Hynde and Black Keys, we all went to the same high school, you know, just in different generations from the same neighborhood in Akron. And then, you know, the company just transferred, Goodyear just transferred my dad to Japan. So I lived there as a kid and I'll be back there in a couple of weeks. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm going on tour there. I'm really lucky. A guy named Keiji Matsumoto, who owns a cafe, Cafe Goatee in Kamakura, he saw Matt the Electrician and I play at South by Southwest like 20 years ago, and he's brings us to Japan on occasion, you know, and it's just a really fun food tour that we get to do, and I get to explore that part of, you know, my life that I didn't as a kid. You don't really know what's going on, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
But I have some stories. I mean, I got my ass kicked a couple of times by, you know, my brothers also got in fights a lot. I mean, I was there in the 70s. So yeah, we're not that far, you know, the Vietnam War is just ending. And, you know, we're not that far away from dropping an atomic bomb on them. And so I, you know, I got, there was some incidents in the, on the playground, you know, and just in general on the streets. And, but I completely understand it, and I'm completely fascinated with that culture. And I just love them. I love their food, and I love their tidiness and their just orderly ways, because I'm such a discombobulated, you know, ADHD songwriter guy that, like, you go over there and it's like, oh, this is peaceful. I'm going to meditate a little bit in this garden,
yeah,
at the shrine, and eat some good food, have the best bowl of soup you ever had in your life. You know, ramen.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, really lucky, really lucky. And I also did a bunch of traveling. That started my traveling thing out, right? But then by the time I got into going to the Ohio State University and studying poetry at a big sports engineering school, I bolted over and I was like, well, I want to write songs, but I don't really have anything to write about. I'm not figuring it out as a young man. I'm like, oh, I can craft a song. You know, I studied songs and I was listening to cool stuff. And I was listening to the history, and I finally heard the Velvet Underground, and I had listened to Sonny Cherry and Brownie McGee and Woody Guthrie. And I still just didn't have any songs, you know, that were really anything happening. So I went over there and I became a street musician in London. And then I went all around Europe, and then I just got addicted to that. And I didn't stop doing that, that life, that vagabond life. I did that for like 7 years, you know.
Wow.
People are always like, are you sure it was that long? I'm like, well, there were times when I had a job, like a bartender or a security night watchman at a, you know, place. But yeah, I was a street musician on and off for 7 years in Europe. So
what does that teach you, Tim? When that's that instant, you got instant feedback when you're a street musician.
Yeah. And hopefully some instant money too. You know, not that was important, but like we had to figure out how to eat and how to shelter and how to pay for the youth hostel or how to whatever, or you're sleeping in the park, you know, which happened to me a couple of times. And the rain and weather can change all that. So you get underground. But I think it teaches you some performance chops, some confidence, how to, it, you know, to your detriment, to my detriment, it would teach me to cope with loud a-holes in bars, you know? You know, just I put up with a lot of shit for a long time. I don't do that anymore. I don't put up with that. I won't do that anymore. You know, I just won't. I like to play listening rooms now. I don't want to be snobby about it, but I'll occasionally still play a rock club or whatever where it's noisy. But I like to play a listening room, and I like to do it alone. You know, I don't mind having a band. And I will play with a band whenever I get the chance, especially a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
But I love to capture, like, Todd Snyder style, like just get a room full of people and make them laugh and make them cry and make them think about something just from stories and songs by one person. Steve Poltz is also very, very good at this. Steve Poltz, Todd Snyder, probably some of the best, you know. I'm really proud to call them friends and that I'll get to work with Todd later on at his songwriting camp in upstate New York. If anybody wants to have a good time, man, end of August, last weekend of August, Big Indie, New York, Todd Snyder songwriting camp. That's going to be a joy. So yeah, I learned a lot busking, you know, and then I lived a life that led to the songs, right? I got involved in relationships that were epic, you know? And so I hitchhiked all around Europe.
It's the time to do it in your life, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, really, this, I could talk about this forever. You know? I get a little misty. It's It's almost like, don't get me started, you know, because you could pick a region and I can spin some yarns right away, just like getting chased by the Carabinieri around Italy or up in Ireland where I hitchhiked with two Scandinavian women and we got separated and then a car picked me up and then I passed them and they didn't see me pass them and they saw me as they were going by and then we got reunited in this van, this surfing, Irish hippie surfing family van, reunited on the same highway. And just amazing things that happened that will always be a foundation for my creativity.
That's great. I'm going to Ireland in a few weeks. So
yeah, man, I was just there. Absolutely love it. You're going to get there in the spring and yeah, you really can't go wrong.
I've never been. I'm looking forward to it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You have to just enjoy yourself. You know, Dublin is incredibly international and diverse now, but you don't have to go very far out of Dublin till you're in a, you know, you're in a very thin country road driving down the wrong side.
Oh yeah.
And if you're renting a car, you know, just get some practice in. You'll be all right.
Yeah, yeah. When I went to Scotland, Tim, our flight was canceled. And so we lost a whole day and we got in at midnight in Edinburgh. And then the next morning we had to rent a car because it was going to where my family's ancestral home was. Huh. And you get in the car and it's a stick shift. And I was like, I got jet lag. I'm sitting on the wrong side of the car. The stick is on the wrong side of the car. I'm driving on the wrong side of the street. The traffic circles are the wrong way. It's a lot. So you're right. Be prepared.
That's my life. I love it. I love Ireland. I love the people. I love the musicality of those people. Their accents sound like singing. Being a street musician there was huge training. Because they're loud, they got big pipes. So there'd be a street musician, you know, 30 yards that way and another one 30 yards that way. And you'd have to find a spot on Grafton Street and belt it out. Today they've got PA systems and looping machines, so it's a little unfair. You know, and they're singing whatever Coldplay hit of the day or Oasis or something, and they're just raking it in. And that level of busking has always been a part of my life. Like when I lived in Paris for a year and I was a street musician with Beck Hansen in 1990-91. And he wrote an essay about it in Annie Leibovitz's American Music book. And he said, yeah, like there we are on the streets, you know, doing our whatever, our Woody Guthrie, Sonny Terry, Brandon McGee tunes, because that's what we were doing along with some Beck originals. And there'd be some guys like singing The Hotel California or The Mrs. Robinson in perfect harmony.
Yeah.
You know, there was some Middle Eastern guys. And they were just like crushing it, you know, with all the harmonies. And they had the biggest crowd, right? And there was a guy on the bridge, the Charles Bridge in Prague, a famous busking spot. After the Berlin Wall came down, that was like paradise for a couple of years. It was just like amazing. And there was a guy that sang Beatles songs, and he had 150 people singing along with him, singing Let It Be, you know, Hey Jude. And we were still stuck to our guns. We're going to play
original.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were playing Muddy Waters. We played some Ween covers. I remember doing Push the Little Daisies. We did REM songs. We had covers. They were just obscure hip things, you know?
Right.
They were the Ramones or we were doing Muddy Waters or Bob Dylan. We were saying, you know, sang some Bob Dylan songs. And then we, you know, we were playing, I wasn't playing John Prine songs as much, but Bill Hanley was. He's a journalist that lives in Philly. And I remember doing one of those with him. And you know, just there was just something about those obscure American country and folk ballads that a certain group of us latched onto. And that's the way it was.
So is it weird now to see Beck and he's like this huge production?
Mm-mm.
No?
He was different from day one. I knew right away. I was like, there's something special about this guy. And yeah, I mean, he understood folk music from day one. Like he sang Woody Guthrie songs when I met him, and he could play like Mississippi John Hurt. And he understood that music, you know, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and Joni Mitchell's Blue, you know, he was there. But you know, we might have ended up at Jim Morrison's grave, you know, meeting some girls from Iceland and singing some classic rock here and there. But that that folk base was already there. So when he got back to America, he just got into hip hop. You know, he was in Los Angeles and he absorbed and took in what was different and new about the cultures around him. And Latin music too, right? Mm-hmm. His first hit has got, you know, Spanish. And so no, it's not surprising to me at all. He's a genius, really. That's what that is. So he's also very motivated and very, very wise. And it doesn't surprise me at all.
He's got half a jellyfish in his band too. That didn't hurt.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. So yeah, John. Yeah. It was a nice scene to get out there and be part of the Largo scene for a while and see John Bryan at work and opening up for him on Friday nights and kind of meeting, like when I got out there, it was incredible. It was like Zach Galifianakis was just trying out trying out his comedy. Tenacious D had just kind of crushed it. And then Jack Black became huge. But you know, you would see these guys trying stuff out at Largo, and it was an incredible time. I'm spacing out on one of the greatest songwriters of the era. Oh my gosh, she was, wow. That's a classic slip of the mind.
This stuff is why I have Pro Tools.
Yeah,
it'll pop in your head, and everybody listen to it later. It'll be seamless. Nobody will know that you didn't know. So. But it's all good.
It's not arriving.
No, you're fine. You're gonna get off the phone with me, and you're gonna be like, "Oh,
when the pawn." She had a really long album title, Fiona Apple.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It was great to see Fiona Apple just trying out new songs or sitting in with John Bryan.
That's such a great time, right? I mean, there was all those people in that, like you said, in that area at that time. A lot of great songwriters, and a lot of that just kind of got pushed away because grunge became so big. But so much great, like, you know, like you said, John Bryan, obviously Faulkner, you got, you know, Manning, you've got, you know, Andy Sturmer, even though he's disappeared off the planet, another great, you know, they wrote some cool tunes.
Yeah. 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 I met Jason Faulkner there a couple of times. It was just really, there was just so many different songwriters coming in there. Elliot Smith was there quite a bit. I got to see him work up close, and his dedication was, you know, deadly, really, is what it was. But he definitely had a way of quieting the room. I was really lucky to be part of that, you know, and it just showed up, and that just happened to be where it was going off, and the Largo scene. At that time, when it was back on Fairfax across from Canner's Deli, that was just a scene that you later find out was quite the ground zero for some explosive creativity.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of creative, let's talk about the album. So like you said, you had a grant, you went up, and I didn't know your mom was Canadian. That's kind of a nice entree. Was it Vancouver or Victoria? Where'd you record this up there?
We recorded in Victoria at a place called Neighborhood Recorders. And that's a studio that was built and owned by Leroy Stagger. And Leroy Stagger is a great Canadian songwriter who I've crossed paths with over the years. And he's become quite the producer, and he's learned a thing or two about the studio and how it works. And he's amassed some amazing equipment. And also importantly, he's amassed a beautiful family, and he's got these musician friends around him that he knows from the scene. From Vancouver and Victoria, from the island and stuff. And they're just incredible, incredible musicians. And he's got them as kind of his ringers for his studio. So he put the band together. He picked the songs. He set it all up for me to be the first artist to come and record at Neighborhood Recorders. And he did a really good job at capturing a live band. Like this is not stacked on a grid. This is not a Nashville pretty folk album that's perfect, like, you know, meaning everything's exactly in time and in tune, and you know, there's noises, there's human being participation on this record, and I am really proud that he captured that of all the things. When you listen to folk albums from the past, it is the human being quality that really, I think, that I'm attracted to. Yeah. I get it. Some people want their things to be squeaky clean and pop-like. This album has got more folk heart, with some songs, some of the best songs I've ever written. And I'm super proud of the songs, from start to finish. And I have been singing them again every day. And hopefully they won't evolve too much. By the time I hit the road with them, they won't change, but they will from time to time. Like, I'll capo them in different places, you know, because the voice changes from day to day, or you might be exhausted and you might bring it down a notch or something like that.
I've never been to Victoria. I've heard it's beautiful.
Hmm.
Is that the case?
Yeah, the walk from the studio, the hike you took, there'd like be bear, you know, scat on the trails. And there'd be a sign saying there was a grizzly bear here this morning. Be careful. So it's like, yeah, you're in nature, in beautiful, beautiful. I mean, it's just beautiful there. British Columbia is beautiful. And then that island itself, super beautiful.
Yeah, I'm into Seattle, but I haven't made it up over the border. I got to do it.
Yeah, got to get up to Bellingham at least. Chuckanut Drive is beautiful, and then you can take the ferry up there from there. It's strikingly beautiful, and if you're a pluviophile, and which is someone that's really into rain, it does create a mood, that's for sure. But it makes those sunny days extra special. And I love going up there to work, and I look forward to going back up there to tour.
Yeah, so let's talk about the tour. I know you're going to be here at Knuckleheads in Kansas City, which isn't really going to be a listening room, Tim. I hate to tell you that. It's kind of a rock venue.
Well, the part I'm playing is a listening room.
Oh, you're doing the – okay, yeah. The smaller room. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I've played outdoors with a train blasting by at Knuckleheads before, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a whole new thing. But I don't mind the train. The train, you know, is like a romantic thing, right? I can work a train into a song just like that. having snuck on so many European trains, hitchhiked all around. Also, you know, today I'm glad I can actually afford the ticket to pay for the train. But I hoboed trains here in America like a crazy man back in the day, and tried to use the Woody Guthrie excuse with the judge when I got arrested. That didn't work out too well. But yeah, the tour is going to be Midwest, and then North Midwest, and then up to Chicago, and then down through your neck of the woods.
Yep.
Oklahoma. Then I'm going to go to Texas for all of June. I'm really proud to return to Texas and play and debut my first show at the Kerrville Folk Festival. I'm really happy that was one of the things that happened for me at Folk Alliance. I was able to connect with the Kerrville people and finally come and play that festival, which many people were always shocked. Like, what do you mean you've never played it before? Even the people that run the festival were like, are you sure you've never played this festival? I was like, yeah, I've never played it before, because it makes sense that I would have played it on the way up or down or around my whole wild career.
Right.
But I did have this moment, even though I was steeped in folk music, I had a moment where I shot, like, all of a sudden I was on a billboard at South by Southwest, and I never played Folk Alliance even, which is where I truly belong. I mean, as much as I want to like crush it at Americana Fest or, you know, whatever, it's South by Southwest. These are all just music business conferences. They don't really mean anything to anybody, but music business folk. Folk Alliance is where I feel the most comfortable. I love Kansas City. I love that it travels around and goes to Montreal next year, for example. And I just like the people there, you know, I love those people. And I love that there's elders that we respect, and there's new kids coming up that are learning new things. And I don't know, that's just the jam for me. And we're all kind of like in one spot. So
like a summer camp almost, right? Because you're all in the same hotel. So I've gone to it for people that haven't been. Yes, most years it's here in Kansas City, down in Crown Center. There are official jams, non-official jams. You're all together. It's much more organic than, you know, South by Southwest has become so corporate.
Yeah.
Right.
And you have to cross all around town, and you have a parking situation or whatever there. They keep it all together in a small tight area. So you're kind of really, you're meeting the people you need to meet in the elevator already. You're just kind of around the proximity level there. And they're both started by Lewis Myers. South by Southwest and Folk Alliance, the great departed Lewis Myers. He was an amazing dude, and he knew that Folk Alliance is going to keep together, keep a closer thing, so that we could really be an alliance and have a true fellowship going on. And I love participating in the mental health aspects of it and just helping people and being of service to folkies. And yeah, so I'll go down to Texas. Then I'll go up to Alaska, which I tour almost every year. And I'll go up to Alaska. I'll play Salmon Fest, which is a festival that helps raise awareness to keep rivers clean. And also as a commercial festival, like Dawes is playing it and Michael Franti and stuff like that. And it's an amazing festival. If anybody here wants to go to Alaska, first week of August, first weekend of August, that festival would be a really cool destination because it's just a, you know, I guarantee you, if you take a road trip to Alaska, your life is going to be altered for the better, and you'll have an amazing trip up there. And then I come back.
So much wanderlust.
Yeah, that's my job. That's what I do. I noticed on this album, I've named about 10 different states, or a lot of states, you know, through it all: Arkansas, Tennessee, I think Ohio might be on there. Anyways, I've named a lot of places in this one. And that's part of the reality of my life. I've been to every state, and I was in every state before I was 40, but I haven't played every state. And the last two on the list are, I have never played Hawaii. I was there when I was a little kid. And I've never played in North Dakota. So I got those two. So if you're out there, you want to hook those up, complete the puzzle. I'm guessing
Hawaii would be a little easier sell than North Dakota for you.
Well, let me tell you, man, I'm like, I write songs about places, and then I end up being there. Like, I wrote a song called The Old New Straitsville Blues, and now it's got moonshine in it and this small town in Ohio, and I end up playing shows around there and people give me moonshine. And that's where I'm like, maybe I should write a song about Hawaii and, you know, kind of envision that thing. Yeah. I've been trying to bust John Craigie's, action, you know, and just get him to open up for me there. Get him to get me to open up for him there. That would be nice. I've been invited to play Hawaii. I just haven't done it yet. And I'm looking to connect that as soon as I can.
You know, I got to ask you this before we wrap up. And this was my I usually do a theme question every year. And last year, my theme question was, what's your travel hack? Like, because musicians travel constantly. And I got fabulous. Like, you know, I think Jamie Harris was the one that told me she brings her own coffee. Like, you know, some people are like, I actually like to sit by the kid on the plane because he's small or she's small, and I know they're not going to encroach on me. I don't care that they're loud. I just put headphones on. So as much as you travel, what are your tips? What makes it easier for you? What do you like?
Definitely water. The water is the more important thing than all of it, I think. Like a good water vessel, container. Like, you want good water, and you want to have your traveling I'm not necessarily, what's the person that's afraid of getting sick all the time?
We're both idiots today. Hypochondriac.
Yeah. Well done, sir. Your coffee must be stronger than mine. I'm partial hypochondriac. So I have like oregano oil, wellness formula. That would be my travel thing. Is like, definitely travel with a pack of like just all the stuff that helps prevent colds, zinc, all that stuff, and a good thing of water, and basically make sure that you express yourself to your hosts or anybody that you need a quiet, calm, clean room to stay in. I think that is a big part of it, being communicative with your people around you, that what your expectations are. Now, your expectations might be too much, and then you have to learn to tamper that and deal with that. But this is the folk music world we're talking about. And the other day, I was offered the room above the club, you know, in a place that will remain unnamed, and it was terrifying. Terrifying. It's so much so that Matt, the electrician, and I want to start a podcast called The Room Above the Club, and get Nels Andrews in there. Because that's what we do when us troubadours get on the phone with each other. You're driving from Tulsa to Oklahoma City. You got time. You'll talk to your buddy. That's when you spit out the shit. You know, that's when you spit out maybe if you have any complaints about life, and you're not going to believe what just happened. And we don't try to be funny and silly about it, but sometimes it's ridiculous and we have to talk about it. So, man, traveling, it really helps to have a lifeline of someone that you can talk to I think so. And but you know, before all that, water and a healthcare kit, that'd be my number one thing that I would tell.
Well, I think
somebody.
It can be really lonely too, especially when you're a singer songwriter. I mean, some people are okay with that, but like me, I'm super extroverted. So, and I grew up in a big family like you.
Yeah.
So it's pretty weird to be alone. And you got, you know, I know comics go through this. A lot of comics are like, you know, they're sitting in a room for hours by themselves to perform for 90 minutes. Does it bother you, or you're okay with it?
I'm fine with it. I might have questioned in the last couple of years, like, I'm like, am I lonely? Like it actually hit me. I was like, is that why I feel this way? Is that loneliness? And so I started thinking about it. But whenever like I'm with my daughter and we're at the something at the mall and some guy or some random person just starts blabbing to me, my daughter is like, that person's like you, you know. Like they have the gift of the gab, like they're like that, you know. Yeah, that's one of your tribe members, the gabby people that can just start shooting the breeze with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I have that, I guess. I don't know, I mean, some people, it drives some people crazy, I'm sure, but hey, makes me a great podcast guest. I mean,
that's absolutely right, man. I could talk to you for days, but I'm going to have to wrap up. How much Japanese do you know? Did you?
Sumasen. Ohayou gozaimashita. I am going to learn a little bit more. I've got some things out. I speak Spanish, right? Yo puedo hablar español. So when I go to Spain and play, I can tell a story about a song now. And I've worked on it, right? I rehearsed. So I can make people laugh in a foreign language. And that is one of the greatest things you could ever do as a stand-up or a songwriter or a troubadour. I just like that feeling. There's nothing better. Most of your stand-ups and your comics, by the way, I'm absolutely obsessed with that world. And I listen to them. I listen to Netflix as a joke a lot on the road. I'm way into that. And I'm way in awe of those people that can do that without any buffer. And I've stolen some of their timing and stuff like that to use for my own things and how to set up jokes and how to finish them and make it complete. But anyways, I forgot the question.
So I was just saying that speaking Japanese and
yeah. Yeah. So I don't speak Japanese, but I'm going to learn a couple of things and like real basic, and it makes you cut the story down to just like four sentences. And then the other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to have someone in Japanese there, a Japanese person, to get up and translate on the spot for me. Not every song. That's the thing with the Japanese tour. There's no talking. You just play more songs, which is great. I want to do that. I'll just play more. But the talking and the storytelling helps you slow down and keeps the hands and, you know, you're not exposing every lick you know in the first half of the show, right?
Mm-hmm.
So every move, like I'll play different variations of songs, you know, just different things, strummy ones, picky ones, bluesy ones, country ones. I'll do all the genres. I'll cover it all. I'll sing Ain't Misbehaving. I'll sing American Standard. I'll do a couple of, I might do House of the Rising Sun, which I've never played, but it was just, I mean, I learned it at the campfire as a kiddo, but I've never played that song live. Just never have. But I love the story about how Bob Dylan stole Dave Van Ronk's arrangement and the animals took it. And it was just in that movie, Perfect Days, which
was it?
Wow, that movie is amazing. You can all watch it on Amazon now if you want, but it's just about a guy that cleans public toilets in Tokyo and how he finds joy in life. And part of it is through music and cassettes. And, someone sings that song. He plays that cassette at one moment, and then another scene, a woman sings like a Japanese arrangement of the House of the Rising Sun. So I did learn that for the Japanese tour. I'll probably throw a Grateful Dead song at him, you know, just for fun. Because over there, it's like, who knows, you know? I mean, yeah, there's deadheads everywhere, but it's just like people don't want to admit, well, except deadheads will admit it, but people don't want to admit that the Grateful Dead actually taught American and the world and suburban youth more about country music and folk music than anybody else. The Beatles and the Stones did too. The Beatles and the Stones showed us how great our music could be. They actually taught America, like, look what you've got here. You know, they reignited our kick. They were the greatest Americana bands in the world, I like to say. Then the Grateful Dead would be the greatest Americana band because they were singing Merle Haggard. They were singing Doc Watson. They were doing old blues. They were doing Mississippi John, Blind Lemon Jefferson. They were doing Lightning Hopkins.
Yeah.
Well, like I first heard Lightning Hopkins through Pigpen singing. So I like that, that band showed probably my first examples of folk and bluegrass were from them. And then I heard, you know, who Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers were and Doc, you know, but first it was the Dead. So, as much as our purists of today don't want to admit that, some will, of course, you know, but they are really, so I'll throw a couple of Dead tunes out. I never do that. You know, I never get to, I don't do that often. I don't know why. I guess as I'm getting older, I could care less about what people think, you know.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say. That's like, yeah. Getting old sucks in a lot of way, but like the one cool thing is you just don't care anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I want focus. I want to put on a good show. Right. I don't want to be just, you know, flighty and all over the place, which is I already naturally am. But there's some songs that mean a lot to me from cover songs, and I'm getting more into playing them. I never did that before. I was, as a kid, it was like, you got to write your own songs. You got to write your own songs. You know, you learn that from the Beatles, but then you realize all of a sudden, oh yeah, they had a couple of years, long years, where they were just playing other people's songs too. And I never did that. I never was in a cover band.
Oh, really?
Never. Yeah, I never got up. When we got up to play, my first band that had any gumption that was really doing it, maybe getting some attention, we might have covered Elvis Costello or the Stones and some Hank Williams and some Leuven Brothers. We back then, we were a freakish anomaly for doing that, you know. And then we got to open up for Wilco and the Jayhawks when they came to town, because we were the only band in town at the time that was singing Graham Parsons and the Clash, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But our set was 80% originals and like two covers that we thought were really cool, like Waiting for the End of the World by Elvis Costello, and you know, something like I don't know, the Leuven Brothers, There's a Higher Power, stuff like that. Stuff that we didn't know. I didn't know that there was a band in the Midwest called Uncle Tupelo that was also covering those songs. We just didn't know that at the time.
Free internet, man.
Yeah.
This has been so much fun, Tim. I really could talk to you for a lot longer, but sadly I have to go, and you probably do too. I would love to say hello to you. You're going to be here in Kansas City on May 29th. Come over and say hi.
Before the show, I'll get you on there. And anybody that's out there that's still listening to this, thank you so much for supporting all the troubadours and circus members of your life. The record is called Find Your Way, and it's going to be out soon. You can hear the single Find Your Way. And something I'm really proud about is a video and a song called Everything That You're Afraid Of. The video is made by my daughter. It's a spoof on like Buster Keaton old golfing video, and it's called Everything You Were Afraid Of, and it's out there. You can just Google it and you can find it on the YouTubes or whatever. And yeah, check out the new stuff, and thanks for spreading the news. You know, I really appreciate the support.
Absolutely. And I always put in the show links, I'll put the YouTube, I'll put your website, I'll put how to buy tickets for people in Kansas City, and I will say hello when you come out. And Tim, be safe. Have a great time in Japan, man. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Oh, yeah. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. Oh, yeah. They got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm going to get me some. Train, but if I have to walk, I'm gonna get the dust and see my motor.